Well, you can say hi if you want to.
Hi, this is
Howdy.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Greg LeMond. Welcome to the VeloCast.
That's nice, really nice, yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the VeloCast. The 105th Tour de France gets underway this weekend. This year it sets off from the Vendée and will cover 3,351 kilometres before the peloton arrives on the Champs-Élysées 21 days later. Now, which of those 21 stages will be key to those hoping to win the key classifications? And who out of those who line up for the Grand Départ in La Roche-sur-Yon stands the best chance of wearing the much-coveted maillot jaune in Paris on the 29th of July? Well, it's just as well we're here to have a stab at answering those very questions, and indeed more. But first, we must address the big news of the week.
Must we?
Yeah, Giro have brought out a new helmet and there's a new specialised Venge. That's what I was talking about. What were you referring to?
Actually, all joking aside, the new MIPS system is really, really impressive in that helmet. It's very good. I thought you were talking about Levi's entering team sponsorship as casual wear sponsor.
Oh, well, you can see the enthusiasm by which we're approaching this weighty topic, can't you?
Chris Froome went from persona non grata to rider in the Tour de France within the space of 24 hours in a timing quirk which looked extremely convenient, but which, if we dug a bit deeper, actually was just two timelines which were, you know, not at all the same, converging on a couple of days to make it look like, you know, ASO banning Froome had prompted the UCI to clear him the next day. As with so much about this case, appearance has been very, very different from reality, though.
It certainly has. I mean, that piece that arrived on Sunday morning in Le Monde was, I can only assume, one of the most duplicitous pieces of journalism I can think of in quite some time, because the person who wrote it, or certainly the person who, inverted commas, leaked that information to Le Monde, will surely have known, A, by that point that Froome had been cleared, and B, the banning of Chris Froome by ASO had been a process that had been set in place 2 weeks prior to that. So it really was quite a distasteful little final pebble on the cairn of what has been an uncomfortable time for the entire sport over the last 9 months.
Can I just say, before we start on this, I completely understand why a whole bunch of people, and I'm not talking about the usual suspects who, you know, will find a way to look at creative flatulence as a performance-enhancing device in cycling, which should be banned. You know, there's a whole group of anti-doping evangelists, if you like, who take it upon themselves to be the guardians of morals on social media, and who, frankly, I've got very little time for. You know, they've become the boys who and girls who cry wolf. You know, they just assume the worst every single time. And like a stop clock, they're right every so often, you know, because there are still people cheating in professional sport. But to look at every performance that's excellent as something that is instantly a result of PED, something that's annoyed me for so long, I almost disregard them. However, I can really appreciate why some people are sceptical about this sport, given the history. You know, going back to Gavis and that famous Flesh Wallone, going back to, you know, the massive time trialist being able to climb. Of course, the affair Armstrong, Ulrich, Puerto, all of that, Contador in his beef sandwich, Bradley Wiggins in his jiffy bag. It's really hard to be a cycling fan, although I would extend that to all professional sports. You know, for me, professional sport is entertainment. It's not the same thing as amateur sport and, you know, the pursuit of excellence for its own sake at all. It is primarily a commercial venture which revolves around sports. So I can appreciate that. However, what the decision about Froome seems to have done is essentially change nobody's mind. I mean, it was a perfect example of everything we've been talking about, or not talking about, for the last 9 months because there was no new news. People had made their mind up. And I think Gary Fairley of the much-lamented Velo Club Don Logan summed it up perfectly in a tweet when he said, you know, all of these guys have been saying, this is a disgrace, we want this resolved, we want it resolved now. And then a brief pause and, oh no, we don't want it resolved that way. You know, people had made up their minds and were looking for a resolution to suit their biases. whatever yeah, we it's, think
it's
about
like
this.
Hiring, it's like hiring a private investigator to find out if your partner is cheating, and then the PI comes back and says, nope, they really are going to the gym on a Wednesday night, and your response is, how dare they not be shagging someone else? Clearly I'm too good for this relationship. That's it, I want a divorce.
Yeah, whatever we think, even with that understandable scepticism, we're in a situation now where this case is finished. It's not going to be referred to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. No further action is going to be taken. We're probably not going to hear any further details, because moving away from it being an anti-doping possibility, where he might have been sanctioned, to an accepted explanation, we've now moved back to the realm of private medical records, which, you know, as Conor McGrain, who I've been chatting to a lot about this, the medical officer for Cycling Ireland, says, this isn't public anymore. You know, this is private. We're likely not going to hear about this. So we need to just accept this and get on with watching the racing. I am not going to spend the next 3 weeks wondering if every time Chris Froome turns his legs, it's because of some salbutamol thing that, you know, has been buried by the cognoscenti, you know, the inner ring, not that inner ring, a different inner ring of cycling, who just want to bury everything. This is over now, and we have to come to terms with that. Otherwise, it's pointless watching the sport if we're just going to pick over every corpse of a case that comes up as the years go by.
Yeah, you know, that interesting thing you said there about this group of people who are, you know, the doyens and the vanguard of anti-doping. Just as you were talking there, it occurred to me that these people are actually anti-fans. Whereas fans derive pleasure from watching cycling, that group of people seem to take pleasure from being against cycling. Mm-hmm. And it's nothing to do with wanting a clean sport, because fans of the sport want that too. I think the difference is that these anti-fans want everything to be corrupt and broken and tainted and deceitful, as that's where they get their kicks.
It confirms some cases, their worldview.
Yeah, and in some cases they've built a nice little career out of it. But... And to that point, what I've seen, and you know I'm not on social media anymore, but I've even seen it in some of the journalistic responses to this case, is that, well, Sky and Froome have, inverted commas, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, bought their way out of a ban. And I think that's looking at the situation through the wrong end of the telescope.
I actually think they have, but not for the reason that people think they have.
Yeah. I mean, it should be seen as WADA have... clearly taking advantage of athletes who can't afford to challenge the findings of what it would appear now to be a flawed test. Mm-hmm. Normally, cycling operates under such shaky foundations that as soon as there's the whiff of a positive test or a scandal, the team disowns the rider for fear of upsetting the sponsor. And without the team and sponsor backing, most riders simply can't afford to challenge the testing, and they accept the ban. Now, absolutely, the test should be robust enough to withstand scrutiny, regardless of how much money the rider and the team has at its disposal. But the thing is that science is never perfect, and while we should have faith in testing, we've got to accept that science itself is just a constantly shifting framework of analysis and counter-analysis. And if it wasn't, we would still think the earth was flat and that leeches cure all ailments. It's madness that some people have so much faith in the testing and so little faith in rider presumption of innocence. I think what's clear from this is that despite what WADA are trying to say, that their test for salbutamol must be looked at now. Mm. Because what's the alternative that WADA couldn't be bothered, or they didn't have enough money to stand by their test? Neither is ideal, but I'd be a damn sight happier for all athletes if WADA now came out and acknowledged the former and saw this as an opportunity to address part of their code.
Yeah, the people I'm most angry, and I'm angry with a lot of people, not least it's got to be said Team Sky, because the way that, not Froome himself, but every time Dave Brailsford opens his mouth, he sounds suspicious to me now. You know, I have no idea why they let him near a microphone. Even in the statement where, you know, they were welcoming the decision not to prosecute the case against Chris Froome, you know, to drop the case, he still made it sound worse, you know. And it, so often, he spends sentence after sentence saying nothing, you know, absolutely nothing, and enlightening nobody. He's made promises like the famous, you know, give us till after the tour, you can all come to Manchester and we'll explain everything. No, it's not going to happen. You know, claiming that Bradley Wiggins was not at a certain race when he was because there was video evidence, all of that centres around Brailsford. And I've said consistently for the last, what, 2 years? Probably longer. Sky, as a management structure, serve the riders extremely poorly. So I'm angry at them. I'm angry at the UCI because, you know, the day before this broke, Le Partien was still making sound bites about it being a complex case to the press. You know, they should have managed this far, far better. And even in their statement, they sounded like essentially they were trying to shift the blame to WADA. You know, it wasn't me, a big boy did it and ran away. But most of all, I'm angry with WADA because, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it. They're not both so poor that the terrible might of Sky's lawyers and the threat of all the money that Sky could apply to them. I think it was Niall, our chum, on Twitter, he said this. It was such that they just had to give up. You know, they threw it in because they couldn't afford to go against Team Sky. And yet they can afford for every single test to be infallible, which is surely financially such a big burden. And what they're, when you look at what they're saying now, when you look at Matt Slater's published some stuff with you know, their director, when you look at what they're saying, it comes across as somebody trying to wriggle out of culpability. I think this has been appallingly handled by, you know, all of the relevant bodies. At best, they look amateurish. At worst, they look complicit and, you know, trying to cover up their own incompetence. And at the end of the day, if you entertain just the slightest inkling, if you're not somebody who's got their made up, if you entertain just the slightest inkling that Chris Froome, from day one, has known that he wasn't guilty of what he was, you know, accused of, try and imagine the last 9 months and what these people have put him through. You know, it should have been private because now that it's not a doping, a possible doping sanction, it's a medical thing, which it was always a possibility, and that's why it's private. They're not trying to hide something. They're trying to protect someone's medical anonymity. And there are probably riders out there racing just now who are going through the same process but whose name wasn't leaked to, you know, to the business. Since 2009, we've been moaning about the processes in cycling, the lack of a trusted system, the sometimes farcical situations surrounding anti-doping, and the fact that the one that always gets kicked in the nads and thrown to the roadside is the rider. You know, Diego Luisi, as you say, his team more or less went, oh, whew, not us. You know, whenever a rider tests an A sample positive, they're thrown under the bus by their team on all but a very few occasions. The only difference is that in this time, Sky actually had the resources not to just dump their rider. Chris Froome is a stubborn bugger who just took it all and carried on through it. If we're looking rationally at the facts, this is finished now. A man has been put through absolute hell. And again, we've had the authorities and the anti-doping organisations exposed as actually probably not fit for purpose. Something has to be done with cycling, but the answer to that isn't to vilify one man. It's to look at the underlying situation and look to rectify it so that this doesn't happen again.
And just, I'm presuming finally on this, you mentioned there what Froome has been through in the past 9 months, and this was something I said right back at the start of this when there was all these calls for he should pull himself out of competition. And I said, but, you know, he can't, you know, because the rationale was if he is banned, then all of the races that he enters, their results are null or have to be addressed and nullified because of his participation in them. But the opposite of that was also true, that if he had pulled himself out of competition and is found innocent, then he doesn't get that time back and he wouldn't have won the Giro, which, you know, is a huge part of what this guy's trying to achieve in his career. So it was completely unfair that this thing had been leaked in the first place. And those seeking to make sure that Chris Froome didn't race or are asking for Chris Froome not to race at any given opportunity across 2018 until this was cleared up must now have to look at themselves and go, well, actually, he's innocent. I need to take all that back. He had the right to race, and we need to stand by the fact that he is innocent. As you say, John, it is now case closed, and we should just go on and hopefully enjoy the tour.
That's never going to happen, though, because the people who had decided he was guilty and the people who decided he was innocent, I'm being completely even-handed in this, minds were made up about this months ago. And it wasn't along the lines of logic, or it wasn't along the lines of, you know, reasoned consideration. It was along the lines of, I'm going to be blunt, I like Chris Froome or I don't. That's essentially what it comes down to. Now, that's not sensible, it's not fair, but that's the situation our sport is in just now.
Well, what I was going to say there is that the difference that we have as of Monday morning is that those that said Chris Froome is innocent because we like them, whether they like him or otherwise is completely immaterial. And I'm thinking specifically of how journalists have to report on court cases where they have to say John Galloway is alleged to have committed blah 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 blah. Whereas as soon as the verdict comes in,
I thought we weren't going to talk about that.
I'll redact that name when I'm editing. Whereas as soon as the verdict is handed down, journalists are allowed to say John Galloway committed blah 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 blah. We now have to say Chris Froome is innocent. Chris Froome was cleared of the assumed AAF that was leaked. So the difference here is we now have an outcome, and the same would apply.
I'm seeing semantic arguments about that already. We don't even want to go there. I really want to just say this case is finished now. I am not going to waste any more time. We promise not to waste time unless there were news developments. We just have to move on. If we're unhappy with the rules, as we've said so often, we have to address the rules. This individual case, you're wasting your time talking about it now. And I don't mean you, I just mean everybody.
No, sure.
Everybody.
Absolutely. Let's talk about key stages on this year's Tour de France. We could possibly talk about them all, but I think it's, for brevity, if nothing else, and we'll be here till the tour actually starts and recording this podcast, we shall pick out some key stages that should actually, in one way or another, decide the overall of this forthcoming Tour de France. So what's the first one from you, John?
Well, I want to take this opportunity to call the ASO a bunch of Jessies.
Okay.
Because we're starting once again in an absolutely beautiful region of France. You know, one of my favourites. A place which has certainly given us huge excitement in the past. And they're missing out on the opportunity for that excitement. We're not going over the Passage de Gouin in the first stage. We're going over the bloody bridge again. That would have been, I mean, seriously, if you want to really, really sort the men from the boys, put them across some seaweed-strewn causeway with sundry bits of sea life trying to nip their tubulars as they go past.
Right, so that's your big complaint thus far. Can we move on to what your actual first stage pick is?
Stage three, it's got to be. 35.5 kilometres team time trial. And I think we've actually seen in previous races before the tour starts some indication of the influence that this is going to have on this year's race. Quite technical, there's a lot of difficult turns. The parkour isn't flat. It's not particularly difficult, but it'll certainly require some intelligent pacing and some discipline from the squads. And this is where everybody, ourselves included, is talking about the big, big difference in time that can be made by squads like BMC, you know, Team Sky, Mitchelton Scott, over, shall we say, the less disciplined climber squads. And I've even seen people say, you know, that the race will be in bed after this, you know, nothing will happen after this, that will be settled because Team Sky will put so much time into everybody else. I think we will see big chunks of time here. Not race-ending chunks of time, but I can easily see Team Sky, BMC, putting, you know, a couple of minutes even, a minute and a half into some of the more uphill-oriented squads. So it will make a significant difference. Now, where I think we've already seen the influence in this is in watching races earlier this year. How often did you and I say, I thought Nairo Quintana went really early, or similar stuff? I think those early attacks are starting to take account of the fact that they might be looking for chunks of time to get back. And the only way you're going to do that, you're not going to do that by jumping out with the last 500 metres of a mountain climb. So I think they're getting their bodies and their minds and, you know, their intent ready for making the kinds of attacks that you need to get back the time that you might lose in the time trial. I think they were practice runs.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's kind of weird because I'm looking around other pieces on the tour and kind of previews of the race. I haven't seen much coverage of this stage being vital for all concerned. People seem to be kind of laying it to one side, go, yeah, it's a TTT, whatever, and it's too early in the race.
I saw somebody say, oh, there will be big differences, but no more than you can make up in one mountain stage. Have you been watching the racing this year?
Honestly, I believe that this stage is more important to the overall than a lot of people are giving it credit for, but happily stand corrected once we get to Paris. Then, now, you were talking about the fact that the ASO are absolute Jessies. Mm-hmm. I think that they've been far from Jesse-esque in their approach to one particular stage, and that's the one that people are calling the Ruby stage, because 2010 we had, what, 13 kilometres of cobbles when a kind of Paris-Roubaix-esque stage was introduced to the tour, 15.4 kilometres in 2014, and then 13 kilometres in 2015. Mm-hmm. This time round, we have 15 sectors of pavé for a total of 21.7 kilometres. And I've heard privately a few riders mumbling and grumbling over, well, just essentially asking why the hell this stage is in a GT. They say it's much, much too risky for a three-week race.
There are cobbled semi-classics with fewer cobbles in it than this. I mean, we will have seen, it may sound like we're skipping over the first week. We will see some action in the first week. And of course, you've got the Mur de Bretagne, where we'll probably see the GC guys pop up. But you're right, after the team time trial, this is the stage. 15 sectors, 22 kilometres of pavé. Serious sectors, you know, we're not talking exhibition pavé, where, you know, like that final sector up to the velodrome. And we've heard indications that, you know, the Amis de Paris-Roubaix and the ASO are taking appropriate actions to stop the riders moving off the pavé and onto smoother sections at the side of the road. So it's being taken very seriously. It's a proper tribute to Paris-Roubaix. We saw the last time in that terrible weather in the stage that Lars Boom won, where Vincenzo Nibali, using the time that he'd spent with Peter van Petegem in training over the cobbles, absolutely just laid down a marker, which, you know, explained much of what was going to happen later in the race. This is a harder stage than that. If the weather's bad, it's going to be absolutely brutal. And I think you'll be looking at some of the riders hoping to make a difference, you know, and I'm looking at people like Nibali, I'm looking at people like Valverde, you know, people who are genuine GC contenders who, when you think about them going over the cobbles, you don't kind of go, oh, that's going to hurt, while some other people will be purely trying to contain the situation, lose as little time as possible. And I genuinely think we could see far bigger gaps here than we see even in the team time trial. You know, you could see people lose 10 minutes if they get it wrong here. Last time on the cobbles, Vincenzo Nibali put the rest of them to the sword. But we saw Nairo Quintana, for example, perform far better than we expected. So I think we'll get some really nice surprises when people that we don't expect to go well in the cobbles handle it with absolute aplomb. But I'd be amazed if we get through this without losing one GC contender completely in terms of credible challenge for the lead. This really sets us up for a very difficult mountain grouping coming in the Alps, where people may have to fight to get back. I think this is absolute genius, and I'm having none of this. It shouldn't be in it because it's too dangerous or it's too hard. This is cycling. It's the Tour de France. You should be a complete all-rounder to be able to win this race, and an all-rounder needs to be able to at least tolerate, maybe not excel on, but at least tolerate the pavé.
Well, I shall pass on the email addresses or set up a WhatsApp group so you can go and throw scorn on those riders who have expressed their doubts as to the number of cobbles they're having to tackle this year.
And to be fair, it is an awful lot of cobbles. I mean, it's a serious bit of stage.
And once they have tackled the cobbles, those who remain in the race will fly down to the aforementioned Alps for stage 10 is the next key stage, Annecy. What a gorgeous little town Annecy is, to Le Grand Bornard, 159 kilometres, which takes in some well-known climbs as well as a new one, the Monte de Plateau de Gilière.
This is an incredibly atypical alpine stage. For me, this offers much of what we usually praise the Pyrenees for. It's steep, It's steep, you know, it's not your long alpine drags. These are climbs which are as testing as anything the Pyrenees has to offer. We've got a bit of gravel, although the gravel isn't like the Finestra. You know, it's essentially a relatively false flattish bit after the climb's finished. But this is mountain after mountain with really leg-sapping gradients. First cat, after a fourth cat, followed by an HC, and then a couple of firsts. And the Col de la Colombière is just before, you know, it descends and then you're into the finish. This is going to be a day of absolutely epic racing. I'm really looking forward to this. And remember, even though, you know, they've had a wee rest, they've got those cobbles in their legs. There's going to be some sore nether regions trying to haul themselves over these steep alpine giants.
And just 2 days later, we have another epic Bourg-Saint-Maurice-les-Arcs to Alpe d'Huez.
It's Alpe d'Huez. It's going to be absolute chaos, as ever. The big thing for me is that the two climbs here that precede it are both at or over that 2,000-metre mark. And this is where we're going to get an answer, if we haven't already, about where Alejandro Valverde lives in the Movistar hierarchy. Because every time that Alejandro has faltered, it's been at these incredibly high altitudes where the air gets just a wee bit thinner and some folks' lungs can't cope quite so well. I'm also, for the first time in years, I'm really concerned about rider safety on this stage. The last time we talked about it, I think, was the time trial when Armstrong was talking about having bodyguards and wanting the thing closed all the way up. I think the frenzy on social media, I'm really hoping it's a bubble that doesn't extend out into the real world, which we've seen so often in the past it is. You know, the average man in the street doesn't have the same passion or anger about the situation. But riders in the proximity of so many fans, the opportunity for someone to take nefarious action is just, it terrifies me. And this is genuinely the first year for ages that I've even given that any thought.
Well, on then to Stage 17, Bagnères de Luchon to Saint-Lary-Soulan and the Col de Portet. Now, at 65 kilometres only, my first question is it too short?
That's something I get asked quite a lot, actually. sorry, cheap shot. I'm too old and it's unworthy of me. There's a couple of things about this. I don't think it's too short. It's the highest Pyrenean summit finish ever. So although it's not a long stage, there's a lot packed into those 65 kilometres. I mean, the Col de Perisord, the Col de Val Luron-Azé is... We're really familiar with Perisord. And the finish, which is the extension above the Col de Portet, is just beautiful. It's short enough that we could see really creative racing, and it's short enough that we could see racing so hard this deep into the race that people just explode and go. Now, it's also the stage where we've got the Formula One start, where they line everyone up in a grid in order, which, I mean, that's just a load of bollocks. It's an idea where somebody's clearly sat down, they've had a bit too many, or a few too many glasses of Vin Rouge at lunch and thought, what will we do to make it exciting? However, the short length and the extreme nature of the terrain, I think, is going to make for a cracking stage. I'm really looking forward to this one.
People think that these shortened stages are something that have come with modern racing, and in the past it was 200-300 kilometre stages every day in the Tour de France. Looking back, we had a 28 kilometre stage in 1972, and that itself had 21 kilometres of climbing, where Cyril Gamard outsprinted Eddie Merckx to take the win. So, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, as the old adage goes.
And they've happened on an ad hoc basis before. Remember in the Climb to Sestriere where the weather was so bad. So essentially they had an uphill sprint with Bjarne Riis, absolutely dominating the thing. And that was still a very exciting day's racing. So I don't think there's anything... I mean, this is the shortest Tour de France this decade, in no small part to the fact that we've got, you know, a very, very creative approach to the length of stages. And I think recent history has shown it to be, you know, nothing but a positive effect in the race. I wouldn't want every stage to be, you know, that way, because as with the classics, there is something about, something really beautiful about watching a really long, difficult stage unwind. You know, watching the effect on people's bodies and their, you know, their body language, their expression, how they sit on the bike. That's one of the great joys of watching professional cycling. But these short stages offer a different kind of pleasure, you know, and it's, I welcome them. I think it's a great innovation.
I'm totally with you on the Formula One grid style start.
Aye, that's
utter nonsense. So then to stage 20 on July 28th, Saint-Pé-sur-Nivelle to Espelette, the penultimate stage in the race, and of course the final individual time trial at 31 kilometres long, being subtitled, of course, Bardet's Nightmare.
Now, this is a really difficult time trial course. I mean, it's a really difficult time trial course. It's technical. There are some sections of 20% climbing. This isn't a drag strip where you can expect, you know, the big engines to take minute after minute out the climbers. You're certainly going to lose time. But it's, you know, it's not nailed on for a good time trialist that they'll put in the kind of performance they need to if they're a big chunk of time behind after the mountains. However, a strong time trialist with their knowledge of pacing, who's still fresh enough to really lay it all out on the road, because this is the last racing stage. Whether we like it or not, the day tomorrow, you know, the final day is essentially a parade now with a crit at the end. So if you're a GC contender and you think you've got a chance and you're prepared to give it your all, then this is the kind of stage that will reward you. But you better be good, you better be technically competent, and you better be a master of pacing, because this route requires all of those. It's a beautiful time trial course.
Which takes us very, very neatly on to the riders that we think will fight it out for the Maillot Jaune this year. And I suppose chief amongst them, going for a record equaling fourth Grand Tour in a row, and indeed a record, another record equaling fifth Tour de France, is Chris Froome.
Aye, he's the favourite of the bookies now. ASO have said that, you know, their attempt to have him removed is obsolete. He's, you know, not under any shadow from the organisations at all. I'm sure social media will be different, and I fully expect to use the mute button with great regularity during the Tour de France. He is apparently producing the best numbers he's ever produced. Now, in recent years, I think he's shown himself to be very vulnerable. I've had quite a few discussions about this in the last week. You know, around all of the happenings relating to the conclusion of the Salbutamol AAF case. And I think in recent years, and Killian and I have talked about this, you and I have talked about this, he's looked like he's under some pressure. You know, he's had to race creatively in order to overcome his opponents and to overcome time that he's lost. And I'm not talking about, you know, going with 80k to go in the Finestra. We've talked about that till we're blue in the face. I'm talking about the wee things where he grabs a second here, a second there, maybe the odd time bonus, because he knows that all of those seconds are absolutely essential, because he's not ludicrously strong compared to the rest. Last year, I think he was beatable, but the others didn't take advantage of the opportunities they were given. There were three or four occasions where I think if somebody had taken the race by the short and curlies, they could have actually put Chris Froome to the sword in terms of the overall. He would still have finished in the podium, but they might have taken the race. But they didn't. They sat back and they let him through those difficult periods. Now, this year, it looks very much like he's going into the Giro out of condition. You know, not unfit by any means, but a wee bit heavy, and not producing the kind of numbers he did. And things conspired to offer him that opportunity, which we saw on the, you know, that famous stage. What that's done is apparently bring him towards the Tour with the kind of form where he's stronger than he was last year. So I think he holds favourite status for me now. He can go in without, you know, anything hanging over him, really. And all of these champions are able to compartmentalise their emotions enough that Chris, I suspect, will not even be thinking about this once he gets to France. He'll be concentrating in the race. He might even use it as some fire to, you know, to push himself to make that extra effort, you know, use it as a negative influence to drive him forward, you know, with anger, if you like, which would make him, even more formidable. So I think he's the favourite, but I don't think he'll have everything his way. I've got a feeling that one person in particular will push him very close indeed.
I mean, I come back to what I said following the tour last year when I suggested, and I think I'm right in saying turned out to be correct, that Froome came to last year's tour with the aim of being like he did with the Giro this year, underperforming at the start, ride himself into form, and the hope that he could take that form to the Vuelta, which was a bit of a surprise for everyone when he announced that he was going to do it. And that certainly was the case, that he was in better form at the Vuelta than he was certainly at the start of the tour. Mm-hmm. And I think the worry for people coming to the tour, given we've got a kind of reversal of that formula, that plan, is that he came to the Giro, as you say, underperforming, rode himself into form towards the back end of it, and now will come to the tour in the same way that he did the Vuelta, looking a whole lot stronger. And I think that also the fact that there's a bigger gap this year between the Giro and the Tour because of the World Cup makes that elusive double more doable than ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm with you, and clearly with the bookies as well. It does make him the out-and-out favourite. And not only because of all of the factors I've just mentioned, but factors that are kind of out with his control, i.e. the parkour itself, I think, for various reasons that we have touched upon slightly, play into his hands and the dynamic at other teams. And I think that brings us very neatly on to the Movistar Musketeers, all for one and probably all for, well, themselves.
If Nairo Quintana can learn that the Tour de France is only 3 weeks long...
there's not a stage 23.
There's no, or 24 or 25, and you don't peak for stage 29. he's definitely a threat, particularly with that time trial actually being hilly enough for him to actually maybe gain some time on sections. It's by no means a mountain time trial. I'm not saying that, but you know, if you're going to limit your losses in a time trial, it doesn't look like a bad course for Nairo. The problem for Nairo is also his potential greatest strength, which is Mika Landa, who I genuinely think could have a breakthrough tour here. This could be the one where we stop thinking about him as a moaning guy who would be a great domestique and should just shut up and ride, or somebody who makes bad decisions about which team he goes to if he wants to be sole leader. I think we could see a Mika Landa who is a very, very impressive creature in this Tour de France. The great unknown for me is Alejandro Valverde. You know, last year, before that horrific crash, he looked in form. He was talking the right game. He looked like a guy who was ready for potentially his best tilt at the windmill that is the top step in the Tour de France. Those three guys together are formidable. They've also got the potential to rip a reduced team. Remember, a reduced eight-man team to rip a team apart in terms of internal strife, domestic loyalty, all that kind of stuff. So until we see how it plays out, Movistar could be the revelation of the race, or they could fall apart like a Jenga tower when you pull out the wrong block.
I mean, that protracted F was not where I thought you were going with that. I mean, this is exactly it. In this announcement that we have, we've got Landa, Quintana and Valverde as three joint leaders. Essentially what we've got here is three tigers, and the Tour de France is a juicy piece of steak you've just lobbed into their cage. The chances of them not fighting over it range from zero to, oh, behave yourself. And I'm sorry, Eusebio Unzu, despite all the talk, I'm not buying it. It's never worked in the past, and I see no reason why it will work here, especially with the egos involved. And you mentioned reduced teams, John. What we have with Sky, and Geraint Thomas won't want to hear this, and I'm sorry, Geraint, in advance, we have seven riders dedicated to one guy. But with Movistar, what we have is five guys split amongst three different leaders. Where do the domestiques work, how do they work for one rider versus another rider, and who do they put their attention to when somebody needs help versus somebody that's further back down the road? It has disaster written all over it. And I genuinely hope that they are the revelation of the team, because it'll make for much more exciting racing. But just, you know, the history of the sport tells us that two joint leaders with big egos never ever works. Three is just abject silliness.
Toothsome it is. It's toothsome.
Toothsome's a good word.
It's gonna give us a lot to talk about, I would suspect. And I think what we also have to remember is whatever anybody says, movie star is one person's team, and that person isn't Nairo Quintana or Mikel Landa.
Right, that takes us to Richie Porte, the Tour de Suisse winner. Looked really good, I think, throughout what was a thoroughly enjoyable Tour de Suisse this year. I guess the only thing you could say is being unable to bridge that 7-second gap at one point to Nairo Quintana on stage 7 was maybe a little bit of a worry for him.
Yeah, I think, and I, you know, I've said this before, I'm, you know, not saying anything new here. I think Richie Porte would have won last year's Tour de France if he hadn't fallen the descent of the Mur de Chat. For me, he looked really sharp, sharper than Froome. He was lean. The team, for once, looked like they were four square behind him. You know, there wasn't the situations we've seen in the past where he was left isolated for long periods of time. And his knowledge of Chris Froome is almost priceless. You know, when they did their training rides up the Col de la Madone together, he'll know how Froome looks when Froome's right on the edge, more than the others, because he's been there for hour after hour after hour in training and in racing. As a domestique, he'll have had insights into the Froome mindset when things are going hard, that he, if he has the courage and the ability to use them, can really put to good effect. I think he looks close to that form this year. I'm not sure he's quite as sharp as he was last year. But again, there's so much difficulty at the back end of this race, that might stand to his advantage. I think Richie Porte, contrary to what I believed a couple of years ago, has a big Grand Tour in him. Yeah, I think he has a 3-week victory in his body somewhere. But he'll have to be absolutely on top of his game. And Froome and, you know, maybe Vincenzo Nibali will have to make a mistake or just be a shade, a few percentage off the top. But Richie Porte, and I really didn't think I'd say this a couple of years ago, is a credible contender for this Tour de France.
And then I guess the only thing that you would have to, you know, query that assertion, because I'm with you on Richie's ability to take a 3-week race. Now, I don't know if it's a tour, but certainly I think there's a Grand Tour in him, which yeah. It is, I don't know. There is that thing with Richie that he always has a bad day. You know, he had a terrible day last year, which cost him the rest of the race. But even before that, in other Grand Tours, there's always something that seems to happen to Richie Porte. Mm. And it might just be the law of averages that at some point he is going to, you know, is all going to click over 21 stages. The other thing that I do have to question is, while BMC, I think, will put in a cracking performance in the team time trial, which will keep Richie Porte up there where he should be contesting for GC and the rest of the race, BMC as a team are shutting up shop, and riders will be looking to impress individually, and that could lead to them being slightly less than 100% focused on Richie Porte if there's an opportunity for a stage win that's going to impress a future employer, if you see what I mean.
No, that's a very real possibility. The only thing I would say is that if anybody is capable of, you know, operating off the back of a Team Sky performance that we fully expect to see, you know, with their incredible depth in that team that can ride other team leaders off their wheel, it's Richie Porte, because he was part of that game, you know, so he knows how it works. Maybe he'll be able to leverage that a wee bit. However, you know, he's got some people who have shown well this year. You know, we saw Greg Van Avermaet working for him far later in a mountain stage than I expected. And people like Paddy Bevin and TJ, if he's fully committed to Porte, and Damiano Caruso, they're not shabby. You know, if they can pull it together and work, and they decide that their best showcase is actually just to do the best they can for their team. Because think what a selling point it would be for you to say, I was part of this, you know, Richie Porte winning the Tour de France. So there's a couple of ways it could play it, but you could easily see attempts at individual excellence as a showcase for their, you know, potential employers. But Richie, I think, can utilise Team Sky a bit better than some of the others, so it might not work that badly to his disadvantage.
Well, I mentioned the penultimate stage being a nightmare for Roman Bardi, and it brings us to how we think Roman Bardi is going to do. Second, of course, in 2016, third last year. He won the Route Sud Ardèche and was on the podium for both Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the Dauphiné. And indeed, he's the only French GC hope this year. But TTs, team and individual, I think, will mean that he needs to be in blistering form to overcome his contre-la-montre handicap.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen him move forward this year. We've definitely seen him move forward. You know, his performance in Strade Bianche was wonderful. He's proven now that he is a consistent top three performer in the Tour de France. You know, that wasn't the kind of fluke that, you know, sometimes throws a surprise up there. He's shown that he's capable of being up there at the sharp end of the race. But his time trialling is mince compared to the people who are his main competitors. It's getting a wee bit better. You know, AG2R as a team time trial squad are more impressive than they used to be. I've been really impressed with them, and how they've managed to work together. They've got a strong squad at this race. You know, Oliver Nason, Matthias Frank, Tony Gallopin, Pierre Latour. You know, it's a really good squad. And it's a slightly hillier race than last year. And with one of those Alpine days, you know, that first one being such a horrible steep day, and with some really difficult technical descents, all of that suits Bardi. So if he can limit the losses that he gets in the team time trial, maybe stay fresh enough to perform well in that final time trial, maybe he can take advantage of the mountains that we've seen. I think he's a solid bet for the podium again. I find it hard to see him in the top step.
Someone who has, of course, been on the top step is Vincenzo Nibali, the 2014 champion. He has Domenico Pozzovivo, who seems to be in the form of his life at the minute, at his side, as well as the Izaguirre brothers.
This is something I did not expect to see as we've watched races develop through this season. We, of course, saw Vincenzo's fantastic win at Milan-San Remo.
He's got... excuse me? I drag you back to my caveat.
No, I've watched it again. It was a great win. He took advantage. Fantastic. He's a great guy, Vincenzo.
Oh, dear Lord.
All joking aside, I mean, he's the rider in the current peloton whose palmarès most resemble those greats that you and I look back to, probably through rose-coloured spectacles sometimes. But he's got that mixture of all the Grand Tours, you know, some really good classic races. He performs over a wide variety of terrains, single day, weekly. You know, he's a really rounded rider. And I was really worried about Barry and Merida as a team. And Vincenzo himself has looked a bit lacklustre on occasion as, you know, we've had the run-up to the Tour. But he's been, you know, he's been beavering away, working in his training camps at altitude, and his team, those golden helmets, have been visible more often than I expected. And if you look at Barry Murray, I expected their team to look weak on paper with the performances we've seen this year. But you're right, Pozzovivo, probably the form of his life. I mean, just a fantastic ride at the Giro. The Izaguirre brothers, always reliable. You know, you can get them to do what you need. Sonny Colbrelli, how often have we seen him at the front on relatively difficult terrain this year? Franco Pellizzotti, I mean, he's getting on a bit, but he's still at the front more often than not. He still drives hard. And Heinrich Häusler, who I think has had a bit of a resurgence this year. So you've got the combination of a strong team, but not strong enough to threaten Vincenzo like we've got with Movistar, and probably not quite, well, not, definitely not as strong as Team Sky. But you've also got a Vincenzo Nibali, who for me has been kind of creeping up in form. After that victory, whether we, you know, disagree about the road blocking and all that kind of stuff. After that victory at Milan-San Remo, he had a good start to the year. And a victory at Milan-San Remo for an Italian rider, he could really do, you know, sweet FA for the rest of the year, and he'd be fine. You know, he's got a big race in his palmarès. Maybe pop up and win another Lombardy just to book out the season. Go for the world champs. Job's done. But I think he's taken this very seriously indeed, and I think we're going to get a surprise from Vincenzo Nibali. I think he's probably, for me, my main contender for Chris Froome in this race. I'm really excited to see what the Italian brings to the roads of France.
Yeah, I mean, disappointing at the Dauphiné, but you're absolutely right. You count out Vincenzo Nibali at your absolute peril. I also agree with you about the team. Well, Pozzovivo and the Izaguirre brothers will be counted on. I think riders like Häusler and Peles Oti are starting to look a bit, despite Häusler actually being better than we have seen him in recent years, they are getting on a wee bit. And the team is nowhere near as strong as you mentioned Team Sky. So there are cracks in that team, or cracks in the armour of Vincenzo Nibali, but it's Vincenzo Nibali. You know, he was as down and out as Chris Froome was at the Giro a couple of years ago, and look what happened there. A superb rider for the back end of a 3-week race, and one that you just can't let out your sight for a minute. So
I've just got a feeling about him.
Yeah, we just don't know with Nibali. As you say, he's been quiet of late, and certainly the Dauphiné performance gave us nothing to indicate how good or how bad he is. He was just quiet. We don't know whether he was looking at his numbers or whether he was really struggling. Only time will tell.
Do you know how sometimes you get the impression he's a stropey wee bastard?
Well, he is, but yeah. That's just by the by.
I also think in the back of his mind is, he's really proud of his victory in the Tour de France when Contador and Froome crashed out. But I think he wants to beat Chris Froome in a Tour. I really think he wants to beat Chris Froome in a Tour.
I think it would be insane to imagine otherwise. Yeah. I think he equally can be as proud of his 2014 victory as any other race he's competed in. But I do see what you're saying. You know, maybe in the long dark nights of the soul, he's got this niggling little voice that says, yeah, but Contador and Froome weren't there.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, I want to make it completely clear, Vincenzo Nibali fans, that year, by the end of it, he looked to me like he would have been the likely winner anyway. And we were actually robbed of one of the potentially great tours of modern times.
Yeah.
By those crashes, because Nibali was in the kind of form that July that you're in once in a lifetime. He was a magnificent rider in that race.
Mm. To a couple of other riders then. Tom Dumoulin is actually a surprise entry for me here. Okay, he has the Giro under his belt, and I thought that Sunweb did really well in saying, no, we're going to hold him back, he's not doing the Tour. But then I was equally surprised as I was impressed by the fact that they've let him go for the GC here after having ridden a Giro, which took a lot out of him. I don't think he's ready for the Tour yet. I think he's too young. I would have preferred to see Tom Dumoulin bypass the Tour this year, ride the Vuelta, and then come back to the Tour and have a proper go at it in 2019.
Yeah, and actually, I'd say the same for Egan Bernal and Team Sky. I'm amazed that they're not just putting them in the Vuelta and then introduce them to the Tour next year. Although if they manage it properly and rotate him through and give him rest stages where he just rides, you know, to recover almost, it might work out okay. Tom Dumoulin, the thing that worries me is how tired he looked at the end of that Giro. You know, we saw Thibaut Pinot essentially break. You know, he had to go to hospital. And Tom, at the end of that stage, didn't look much better. And although we've got that extra week between the Giro and the Tour, it's hard to see him being able to recover the kind of sharpness he needed in this, you know, in this kind of race. But I think he is growing as a rider all the time.
Mm.
You know, the Tom that we saw win the Giro is definitely someone who is capable of winning a Tour. I don't think it's this year. I'd agree with you.
Yeah.
I'd love to be wrong, because I love him as a rider. Absolutely love
him. But anyway, moving on to, I think, unless you've got others, for me, the last two riders, I forget which one it is. Is it Simon Yates or is it Adam? Whichever one is going to line up on Saturday for Orica, or Mitchelton Scott rather. Miles Jone, no. Best run rider, nailed on.
I like to think of the Yates brothers as something from the set of Westworld, where essentially they're in some kind of storage unit and they just screw a different head on depending on which race they want.
I tell you what, I want 24-hour live coverage of the other Yates brother on at all times during the Tour, just to, you know, so we can guarantee that there are actually two of them, because I'm still not convinced.
Yeah, for Mitchelton Scott, I mean, one thing, and it's nothing to do with the GC, Caleb Ewan not going is a direct result of two things. One is because I would love to have seen Caleb Ewan at the Tour, and he was expecting to go there. I mean, it provoked another outburst from, not the politician in America, Rick Delaney. but Yates, Adam, is apparently slightly stronger just now than Yates Simon was at the start of the Giro. It could... I mean, you're right. The young rider jersey is absolutely nailed on for Adam Yates. But I think it could be certainly a podium. And given a following wind, sky's the limit. I mean, we've seen young riders burst forth with displays that, you know, announced their full arrival in the world stage. Not so much recently, but, you know, back in the 80s, for example. I'm thinking it'd be people, of course, like Laurent Fignon and that kind of thing. If we got a ride from Adam Yates that is absolutely everything he is capable of and everything falls into place, I'm not saying he can't win yellow. I don't think he will. I think he'll be on the podium, but it's not out with the bounds of possibility that he could. The team are decent. The crucial member of that team is Mikel Nieve. I'm still amazed that Team Sky let him go. You know, there are some others who will be useful, particularly in the team time trial. Can you imagine riding that Roubaix stage with Matt Heyman on your team and Jack Bauer and Luke Durbridge? You know, if any team is prepared for that cobbled stage, which we highlighted as one of the crunch points in the race, it's Mitchelton Scott. So I think Adam Yates will win a tour, I'll say that now. I would be absolutely ecstatic if it was this one. I don't think it will be. I think he'll have to wait for the end of the era Froome.
Now, the runner-up on last year's Tour de France, of course, was Rigoberto Urán. And the Colombian rider has actually looked good this year. On the negative side, I think we can safely say he needs a better team and a better individual time trial to be sure of even replicating his position in last year's Grand Boucle.
Yeah, he's looked in decent form. I think his team looks better. I mean, his team looks absolutely fantastic if you're looking at snipe and stage wins. You know, if you've got Sepp van Marck, Cy Clark, Pierre Rolland, all in a team, any of those guys, as well as some of the others, could nip off up the road and snipe a stage. And that, let's be honest, that would save the race. You know, if Education First, Rafe Pack, presented by Cannondale, get their first stage win, they've succeeded. You know, they've absolutely succeeded. They'll come away from the race happy. Urán last year, I think, was a magnificent performance from Urán, and it was great for the team. I think he might be top five if he rides a good race. I can't see him on the podium again.
Let's move on then to the green jersey competition, as well as looking at some of the sprinters. Now, for the green jersey, I think it would be a very, very foolish man who said anything other than Petter Sagan right now.
Right, two things can stop Petter Sagan winning the green jersey. One, a poor decision which is subsequently proven to be absolutely rubbish by video evidence that was available on the day. Not that I'm in any way in favour of Sagan. Or he falls off. That's it. You know, there are stages in the first week which have got Sagan stamped all over them. It wouldn't surprise me if he won in the, you know, Mur de Bretagne. There are stages most weeks that Sagan could have. The important thing about Petter Sagan is consistency. He's up there all the time. On his best day, he can beat the sprinters. On his worst day, he can be top 10 in a sprint. On his best day, he can take on the classics guys. I mean, he won Paris-Roubaix this year, for God's sake. You know, he's capable of winning in everything except the high mountains, and that means the green jersey falls to you unless you do something wrong. The only slight fly in his ointment, I would say, is Michael Matthews and Team Sunweb. And whether Matthews is allowed to take the kind of action that would make him a genuine challenger for Petter Sagan's green jersey will depend on Tom Dumoulin's form, I think.
And of course, Matthews was the green jersey winner last year, and I remember saying, as objectionable as it was at the time, that Petter Sagan's exit actually opened up the green jersey competition into being something really exciting and worth watching till the end, because we had Kittel move into it, and then because of Matthew's ability to climb better than Kittel, Matthew slowly dragged himself back into it, and it came right down to the wire. Again, I think this year, I mean, you've got Tom Dumoulin sitting on Sunweb, which could be as big a barrier as Petter Sagan is for Mick Matthews going for that green jersey.
Yeah, but Matthews is capable of it. You know, he's the one guy who we've seen him, you know, exceptionally visible really late on difficult mountain stages. We've seen him win sprints. I mean, he's kind of Petter Sagan with an Australian accent and, you know, he's that kind of caliber of rider. So if Michael Matthews is on top form and has free rein, then we might see a competition. But it's, I mean, it's hard to see past Peter Sagan, in the way it was hard to see past Sean Kelly or Eric Zabel. You know, it's just a jersey that, however they tweak it, they've got everything they need in terms of skills to win it. And you know, Sagan is proving one of the greats of that particular classification. I think he'll win it again.
So moving beyond the actual green jersey competition to the individual sprint stage winners, who do you think is going to be vying for those titles? Because you've said in recent shows that the sprinters, with, as I say, the green jersey itself, but actually just taking stage wins, that competition as awesome. Unofficial as it is looking really, really mouthwatering.
Alexander Kristoff, Peter Sagan, Mick Matthews, Arno Demar, Dylan Groenewegen, Sonny Colbrelli, Andre Greipel, Marcel Kittel, Fernando Gaviria, Magnus Kort-Nielsen, Jesper Stuyven on the right day, you know, John Degenkolb if he refines the kind of form he had. It's just packed with world-class sprinters. I think Quickstep have been really clever because I couldn't remember whether they were taking Viviani as well. Of course they're not. They're doing what they did last year, which is they're bringing one of their big guys to the tour, and that's Fernando Gaviria, without a doubt. And they, you know, they almost broke Viviani in by giving him the full attention at the Giro. I think we could see different winners every single day in the sprints. Or, and I'm not hedging my bets here because we've seen both of these in previous tours, so both are genuine possibilities. Or we see one guy, and I'm thinking Marcel Kittel last year, you know, or Mark Cavendish in any number of years, we see one guy just time it perfectly, have one of those magical few weeks where every gap seems to open instead of close. When he pushes down in the pedals, you know, they just turn and he's in the right gear. We see one guy just have the most blessed of tours and just crush it. But that, if that guy exists this year, they'll have beaten what I think is one of the finest fields of sprinters we've seen for many, many years in a Grand Tour.
And you didn't mention up until right the end there, Mark Cavendish. Are you possibly saying that Cav isn't going to be up there with that very, very impressive list that you rattled out?
I'm saying I've got no idea, actually.
Okay.
the thing with Cav is you genuinely don't know. I mean, when he did that beautiful thing where he did the beaches in Normandy. And that year you're going, oh, he's a great ambassador for the tour, you know, it's wonderful to see him in older statesman status. And then he just bossed the thing. So, you know, Cav, you can never write off Cav. I genuinely, and this is not because he's English speaking, because if you go back to old Velocast, I found him really annoying an awful lot of the time when he was younger. I think he's the best sprinter who's ever turned a pedal.
And the one rider that you didn't mention in terms of sprint is here to be mentioned, if only for the controversy that will be in his wake. That's Christoph Laporte, who has been selected over Nasser Bahani for Cofidis.
I couldn't believe it when the reports came through that Nasser Bahani had been racing with double vision. I mean, since the crash at the Tour of Yorkshire. Can you imagine letting a sprinter race with double vision? I mean, that's verging on abuse.
Let alone Nasser Bahani.
I mean, Nasser Bahani's dangerous enough when he can see where he's going. And I mean, I'm being vaguely flippant about that, but you think about the centimetres which define the gaps. You know, we've seen the Dutch National Championship taken by Matthew van der Poel, who may very well be the best, you know, all-round road rider in the world just now, certainly for his age, where he went through a gap that, to me, didn't look to be there. I mean, it was astonishing. We saw Fernando Gaviria a couple of years ago at the Giro do the same thing. We can think of countless indications where Mark Cavendish has ducked his wee head and gone through a gap that just shouldn't be there. Now, there you're talking about a centimetre making the difference at 60 kilometres an hour about whether you clip someone's wheel or batter their elbow or overlap a wheel that you don't need to, and suddenly you've taken down the entire peloton. It is absolutely, I nearly swore there, absolutely stupid to let somebody race with double vision. So, yeah, I mean, it's, it's a controversial decision because everybody wants, well, a lot of people want Nasser Bahani at the race, and, you know, he's a colourful character. He always gives us stuff to talk about. But it's a no-brainer. You know, if he's got double vision, shouldn't he be racing? Laporte should be there. End of story.
Yeah, but I also think that what happened on stage one of the recent Route de Occitanie had as much to do with it as the double vision. If they're prepared to race Nasser Bahani still suffering the effects of a concussion, they would have been prepared to take him to the Tour. The fact that he was told to be the lead-out guy for Christophe Laporte on that stage and then raced his own man to take the win probably has as much to do with his non-appearance at the Tour as anything else.
Probably couldn't see him.
Or why was an entire Cofidis team getting in my way?
I thought the finish line was 3 metres later.
You mentioned Fernando Gaviria. I think he's the guy to watch for the sprints for me. I think Gaviria is going to start to rise in the same way that we've seen Kittel or Cav in the past. He's just looking so, so impressive at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, that could very well be true. I also think, in the back of my mind, that Cav has one more magnificent exploit in him. You know, one week where he's just Cav. So it wouldn't surprise me, particularly in the first week where there's many opportunities to see Cav show the young guys a wheel or two.
Right, some housekeeping before we go then.
There's a couple of things. We've made the last few shows free to give people some idea of what to expect. I'll pop on the feed a wee compilation of Ashley House's finest moments from last year's Giro, so you can get a feeling for Ashley's contributions to the show. He had a difficult Giro in terms of finding time to work for us. I've been chatting to him, and we're far more confident that he'll be able to join us for the Tour, which is great because, you know, frankly, I missed him. He's become a mate. So if you've enjoyed the last few shows, and you can go back in the feed and listen to older stuff, and you think you might enjoy joining us for a variety of daily shows from the Tour, including, you know, input from Kelly and Kelly, our history buff, then please visit velocast.cc and consider subscribing. By the time you hear this, it's likely there will be two packages, a single one where you can pay £17.50 and just get daily shows from the Tour and our Tour wrap up the day after the Tour finishes, or, you know, you can subscribe for a year or subscribe for a month, although those involve, you know, slightly more commitment in terms of time than the one-off Tour package purchase. The other thing is we're just finishing polishing the corners of the website for velocast.tours, which will go live in the next few days, which is essentially, we've wanted for years to do a tourism package, and we're doing packages for the classics week between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, a week or 9 days at the Giro, and a trip to the World Championships at Yorkshire next year. Now, the big thing about these is they're not focused on riders. You know, there are loads of packages where you can go and ride your bike, you know, for the Étape de Tour or a big sportive or, you know, whatever. These are focused on watching the race, a VIP experience where you get behind the scenes access, meet some riders, get to absorb some of the culture that the races move through. And we've got already our agenda for the Classics Week between Flanders and Roubaix on the site, which you can have a look at. You can leave a deposit now. You can leave a slightly smaller pre-reservation deposit for the Giro Tour, which we haven't been able to fully flesh out yet because the route hasn't been announced, or for the Tour of Yorkshire Tour next week. We're working with someone with 2 decades of experience in leading tours, someone who spent the last decade deep within these races, leading tours for people, all of whom, I mean, the feedback that she's got over the years is absolutely amazing. And we didn't want to do it until we could partner with someone who would offer absolutely the best experience. So we're there. It's our new venture next year. Have a look, and if you're interested, please get in touch. But other than that, I hope you'll consider joining us for the Tour de France, because I think it's going to be a cracker. I mean, we've got a deep, deep field of riders with a lot of talent and a parkour that looks fantastically interesting. So you can do that, as I say, at velocast.cc.
Well, thank you very much for joining us for a look ahead to the forthcoming Tour de France. As John says, we've got daily shows from us coming up. We've got daily shows from Ashley House, and Killian will be popping in to hit us up with some historical tour facts too. And all of that gets underway on Saturday for the Tour de France Velocast.